Well, welcome back again to this study of Proverbs, one of the English Bible's five wisdom books, and an enigmatic book, and for many a book that is not easily navigated, not readily understood. But I'm hoping that you're getting some blessing and some understanding of this booklet. Of this book as we go through it. Well, the last thing we did was chapters 5 through 7. And just to recap from where we have been and where we are up to now, we started in chapter 1, and we saw that chapter, title the study of that chapter, The Vulnerable One. The Vulnerable One. And for a key verse, I chose verse 14 in chapter 1. Throw in your lot with us. So the title and the key verse. For chapter 2, we could call that study. Chapter 2, we could call it Integrity Away from Home. And I chose as a key verse for that chapter, verse 9 of chapter 2, integrity in every circumstance. That's what that verse says. And then in chapter 3, we could label that study, God is the good in life. And that was derived from the key verse of verse 16, long life, riches, and honor. Chapter 4, we could call that study the example of your father. And that came from the key verses that were verses 1 and 3 of that chapter, which basically say, remember your father and your grandfather. So that was chapter 4. And then chapters 5 through 7, that study I like to label sex, money, and character. And the key verses for that section, chapters 5 through 7, are verses 23 of chapter 6 and verse 2 of chapter 7, both of which refer to life. And let me just give you the 6:23 one. Discipline is the way of life. So we have these five sections, chapter 1, 2, 3, and 4. There's four of them. And then 5 through 7 is another section, all its own. And these sections correspond to stages of life in the young man. Now, by young, we mean, you know, from, let's just choose a teenage, you know, say 15. From about 15 through, mid-30s, maybe even approaching, you know, 40, but under 40. So say 15 to 35. And each of these five sections, chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then 5 through 7, its own section, each of these appears to be targeted toward one of those age groups. Now, this is not a widespread, not a extremely popular interpretation of these first seven chapters of Proverbs, but it is supported by some pretty good authorities. J. Vernon McGee, for example. Henrietta Mears is another example. And I'm sure there are more. And I think it's a really good way to look at these chapters. Again, it doesn't change the text, and it doesn't necessarily change the interpretation of the text, but it does give us a good framework with which to grab hold of, get a handle on these chapters. So backing up and still reviewing, let's go back to chapter 1. And just a quick recap before we launch into chapters 8 and 9. So chapter 1, as you can tell from the title, The Vulnerable One, that chapter we characterized, we saw proofs within the chapter that this is probably addressed to the audience of the young man still at home. And we gave 5 proofs for that. And in fact, we gave 5 proofs for the interpreting the audience for each of these sections, 1 through 4 and 5 through 7. The young man's still at home. He's still under his family's protection and authority. And you can go back to that recording and see how we did that. While we were in chapter 1, we also spent some time on the fear of God, and that was a separate recording, a separate podcast. Go ahead and check that out. I think you'll find it very resourceful, very useful, on the fear of God, what it is, what it isn't, and why it has a prominent place in the book of Proverbs. And in fact, it's mentioned, I think it was 8 times, or more, I forget, but and we defined the fear of God as knowing our place before Him. And you'll recall in chapter 1, verse 7, that Solomon said that if you want to be wise, you have to begin with a relationship with Jesus Christ. You have to begin with a relationship with God, which of course is enabled through Christ's sacrifice for us, that relationship. Chapter 2, we called The Young Man Newly on His Own. So we said the target, the audience, was the young person who's newly out on his own, and all the challenges and all the opportunities and all the things that will occur that he will run into in that circumstance. And in fact, that's why the word circumstance comes up so heavily in that chapter 2. And that, as the key verse indicates, that Solomon, taking the place of the hypothetical father, is telling this age group, that the key thing is to stay faithful as you run into every new situation out on your own for the first time. All right? And then chapter 3, as we talked about, that was the young man making his way in the world. Now, he's not only not in the home any longer and out on his own, but now he's actually concerned with his first getting a job and his establishing himself in that job, in that career. And that's why the key verse there, long life, riches, and honor, is very appropriate, because those are the things that are on his mind. On his mind is, I want to establish, the rest of my life in what I'm doing right now. I want to make my place and make my imprint on the world and have all the things coming to me as I, launch out as a young man. And then chapter 4, we said that was addressed to a father, a new father. So this is a later stage still. He's a new father. He's already spent some time establishing himself in his career, and now he's a young father. And Solomon is addressing that age group with particular advice and exhortation that is designed for just that age. And then the last section, chapters 5 through 7, we said this is the man who now he's been married and a father and he's established in his career and all those things. And now, let's say he's mid-30s and he is pretty secure in his income and in his job, and he's been married for enough years that, let's face it, he's a little bored with his marriage, maybe he's a little bit bored with his life and bored with his job, and we would call that what? We would call that midlife crisis. Now, I'm not saying that Solomon would have even have known of that phrase or have said that, but that's essentially what this is. This is a young man who he has the resources and the time and everything else that would enable him to have a lot of time to think and to do things he wouldn't otherwise do. And this includes bad things. And that's why chapters 5 through 7 are rife with warnings against adultery and warnings about how to use your money and warnings about your lifelong reputation that, you know, don't ruin it now. You've come this far. Don't do things that will hurt the rest of your life. And that's why we chose the key verse, discipline is the way of life, and the study title, sex, money, and character, because that's exactly what's going on there. So we have come this far in our study, and the next thing that comes up is, of course, chapters 8 and 9. Now, 8 and 9 is a section also, and 8 and 9 is significant, chapters 8 and 9 are significant in that, in a few ways. First of all, they're significant in that Solomon is winding down or wrapping up his youth primer, his sermon to youth, you might say, his TED talk, if you will, addressed to the young man. Again, we would call it 15 to 35. And what he does in 8 and 9 is he essentially switches from addressing an age-appropriate group to all the groups. So in 8 and 9, he's addressing all five groups. Group 1 in chapter 1, group 2 in chapter 2, group 3 in chapter 3, group 4 in chapter 4, and group 5 in chapters 5 through 7. And so in 8 and 9, he actually revisits many of the things that he spoke about in chapters 1 through 7, including adultery quite a bit, including the use of money, and including your character. So it's kind of interesting, especially he does revisit 5 through 7, especially. So we can consider it Solomon's summary, his summary pleas, his summary exhortations to the five young men age groups. So that's one way that chapters 8 and 9 are significant. And that's what we'll look at first. But there's also another very important way that chapter 8 especially is very significant. And we'll have to spend some time just talking about chapter 8 by itself because it is very, very important. In fact, chapter 8 is probably the second most controversial chapter in Proverbs. The first being chapter 31. And chapter 31 is a topic of a lot of debate among women primarily. And chapter 8, on the other hand, is very controversial and a big subject with theologians and with Bible expositors and with Bible students. And we'll see why. But to give you just a preview of that, chapter 8 is somewhat like chapter 119 of Psalms. Chapter 8 of Proverbs has somewhat the characteristic of chapter 119 of Psalms. Now, the Psalm 119 magnifies and celebrates and really delves into the Word of God and how great it is, how wonderful it is. Well, Proverbs chapter 8 does the same thing with wisdom. The whole chapter, chapter 8, celebrates and venerates and even to the point of personifying wisdom. And why it's so significant is, number one, It is one of the best treatments on wisdom. And remember, the other one is in Job 28. We looked at that earlier, Job chapter 28, which is also a chapter just on wisdom. But Proverbs 8 does this on wisdom and makes it really, really a wonderful thing. In fact, the thing that chapter 8 says the most about wisdom, the main point it is making is that it is so great to the point that it is the tool that Almighty God used to create the universe. Okay, that's kind of the key thing in chapter 8. There's a little more than that there, but the main thing in chapter 8 is, reader, understand, wisdom is so great, so powerful, so wonderful, so far-reaching, so magnificent, that it was actually the tool that the Creator God used to create the universe. Now, that in itself is very, you know, very wonderful. A second thing that's going on in chapter 8 is that we can see a very rich parallel between chapter 8 and the New Testament. In fact, the Gospel. And in fact, the person of Jesus Christ. There is a little bit of debate on that score. We will have to wade into that. We'll have to wade into those turbulent waters and sort of make our way. But we will, and I'll try to, you know, summarize and simplify. But it is a contentious with some, not with me, but it is a contentious section for many. And there's a lot of talk and discussion about, well, is Jesus really, you know, illustrated there, or is he not, and so forth. And we're going to have to address that, and because it's one of the most important chapters on the person of Jesus Christ. We'll have to. In fact, it is so controversial, in fact, that very early in the church's history, second or third century of the church's history, after Pentecost, the very first heresy that arose in the church was actually had some connection to this chapter. So again, we really can't avoid addressing that. And then the third thing that we will explain and parse out of chapter 8 is chapter 8, like other chapters in Proverbs, is rich in personification. But unlike the other chapters, the whole chapter is personification, pretty much the whole thing. Whereas, you know, we have a little bit in chapter 1, a little bit in chapter 2, a little bit in chapter 4, you know, and so on. But here in chapter 8, virtually the whole chapter is personification. And so we're going to have to address, well, why? Why did Solomon use personification? To what end? You know, what did he intend to do? What did he hope to do with that particular technique and that tool? And we should look at that, because it explains the other uses of personification, and it explains personification itself as it's been used throughout history and also used in the Bible. Okay? So that's what we'll do. So, chapter 8. So we're going to do chapter 8 and 9 as a section. I don't know how many lessons we'll have to unfold this in, but we're going to have to do more than one for sure, because it's pretty big, pretty rich. All right, so let's get started. Chapter 8, verse 1. Does not wisdom call, and understanding lift up her voice? On top of the heights beside the way, where the paths meet, she takes her stand Beside the gates, at the opening of the city, at the entrance of the doors, she cries out. Now, do you see there's personification here already? To you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of men. O naive ones, discern prudence, and O fools, discern wisdom. Listen, for I shall speak noble things, and the opening of my lips will produce right things. For my mouth will utter truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the utterances of my mouth are in righteousness. There's nothing crooked or perverted in them. They are all straightforward to him who understands, and right to those who find knowledge. Take my instruction, and not silver, and knowledge rather than choicest gold, for wisdom is better than jewels, and all desirable things cannot compare with her. Well, let's stop there. Well, this is pretty interesting. This is pretty interesting. Let's divert a little bit from this and cover one more thing that we should have covered before we started, and that is I wanted to give the five indicators or five proofs of the subject. I'm sorry, not the subject, the audience of this section. Let's start with looking over at verse 32, which we haven't actually got to yet, of chapter 8. And it says there, "Now therefore, O sons, listen to me." O sons. Now, there's nothing unusual, is there, about Solomon saying, you know, son. He says it so many times. And we know from studying this already that he's not talking about a literal son. But what has changed here, and it actually changed in chapter 7, at the very end of chapter 7, and then now in chapter 8, is he's changed from the singular to the plural. Now, he did use the plural back in chapter 4, but I think that's the only other time he did that. So pretty much beginning here, he's shifted to the plural. And this is one clue, this is one indicator, that he's talking to more than one age group. You could say that he's talking to the audience that has anyone to whom what he is speaking will apply. In other words, to all the people to whom this will apply is whom he's addressing. So that's the first clue. The second clue we just read in verse 1 of chapter 8, does not wisdom call an understanding lift up her voice? He's saying, haven't I told you already about wisdom? Haven't I given you a lot of indications, a lot of advice about acquiring wisdom and what wisdom is and how to get it into your life? So again, he's kind of summarizing with all the groups. And then if we jump over to chapter 9 and look at verse 4, we'll see he says here, whoever is naive, and by the way, this is wisdom speaking, but again, Solomon, you know, personifying wisdom. Verse 4, whoever is naive, let him turn in here to him who lacks understanding. All right, so that's the third clue, the third indicator, that he's still talking to those people that need to change. Remember, we define the naive person as the person who is comfortable where they are. They're complacent. So he's still addressing that individual. Only now he's doing it as a group. And in fact, in the same chapter, chapter 9, we drop down to verse 16. He says it again, whoever is naive, let him turn in here, and to him who lacks understanding. He says it again. All right. Also in chapter 9, if we go up from where we just were, up to verse 13 of chapter 9, and then read through 18, that whole block, that whole paragraph, we actually have a reprisal. We have a revisiting of chapters 5 through 7, which is about the adulterous woman. Okay? And then we can look at chapter 8, verse 1. Once again, does not wisdom call? And chapter 9, wisdom has built her house. And, of course, this is personification of two voices. He's saying, all you young men, 15 through 35, there are two voices calling you. You need to know who they are, identify who they are, and choose which one you will answer. And the first one is, of course, wisdom in chapter 8. And the second one in chapter 9, verses 13 through 18, but especially 15, calling to those who pass by, verse 15, is not wisdom, but is the opposite, the folly. In fact, some Bible teachers call this the woman of folly. We have the woman of wisdom in 8 and the woman of folly in 9. And that's appropriate. That's appropriate. It's actually the adulteress, if you read the paragraph, but those are good labels. So we have five indicators, five clues as to who this audience is. And again, it's the whole five groups. Chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, and then chapters 5 through 7, that's five groups. And now Solomon is addressing all of them together. It's as if he got all, you know, he got a representation, he got a person who represented that age group from each of the age groups and put them in a room, and now he's addressing them together, so to speak. All right, so back to the text. Now, you know that we've read chapter 8, and we have seen that there's personification here. Let's go ahead and read. We already read 1 through 11. Do you see what's going on here? You see what's going on? Look how many times there's personification here. Verse 1, her voice. Verse 2, she takes her stand. Verse 3, she cries out. Verse 4, I call. Verse 6, I shall speak. Verse 7, my mouth. Verse 8, my mouth. Verse 10, take my instruction. And then verse 11, nothing can compare with her. Almost every verse in those 11 verses. And what Solomon is doing is he's using personification as a tool. Now, we'll spend some time a little later on what the reason is from doing that. But let's just see what the effect is. Let's just look at the effect. We see it in chapter 9, too. Look over at chapter 9, verse 3. She has sent out her maidens. She has prepared her food, verse 2. And wisdom has built her house, verse 1 of chapter 9. So what we have there is Solomon using a woman, personification in the form of a woman, to appeal to the reader. It's kind of like what we do with, many times ships and planes and things are called her or she or, you know, and even in conversation we'll refer to cars or trucks or boats or motorcycles. You know, it's kind of funny the way we do that, isn't it? And what we're doing is we're reinforcing our emotional attachment to that object by not only making an inanimate thing animate, but by giving it an even further personification, giving it an actual gender and a human characteristic, which is quite interesting. And it's, you know, nothing new. It's pretty much been done throughout the history of man that we've done that. But here Solomon is using that, and he's doing that, and isn't the first time, as I mentioned, chapter 1, chapter 2, there's many other places where he does that. Chapter 3 as well, chapter 4. He has used the her and the she when speaking of wisdom. Now, you probably had it occur to you that even in Western history, this has been a thing with us, that we have made wisdom a woman. We've personified it as a she. Think of the name Sophia. The name Sophia, which is actually an anglicization of Greek, really means wisdom. The word means wisdom. That's what it means. And the Jews also had a woman name that they applied to wisdom. they did it a little bit differently, whereas the Greeks actually made Sophia a goddess, the Jews did not make their Lady Wisdom, which was Shamath, did not make her a goddess, which would, of course, been, you know, prohibited in Judaism. But it is interesting, though, as I say, that in Western culture, this is not not absent. We have this in Western culture. We understand that we do this sort of thing, that we do use personification. So why is he doing it? Why? Why does he personify wisdom? Why does Solomon do that? Well, the same reason we do with trucks and cars and boats and, you know, we want to have an emotional attachment. And in this case, he's letting the reader have the benefit of seeing wisdom as not just some ethereal, disjointed, dispossessed thing, but actually an important, human, viable thing. Even to the point where he'll say in Proverbs, make wisdom your sister. He even says that in a place in the book. Make it your sister. Make it a family member. Bring it into your family as one of your hosts, your family members. Now, let's see how that plays out. As we read chapter 8, and we've already read the first 11 verses, look how he starts out. Does not, verse 1, does not wisdom call? Well, what he's doing there, since he's just spent three chapters on talking about the folly of adultery, now he's saying, does not wisdom also make itself known and available? It calls at the corner, at the center of town, and calling to all who pass by, just like folly does. Exactly the same. Exactly the same. Let's look at the very end of chapter 8. This is a very important verse. The next to the last verse in chapter 8, verse 35. For he who finds me, that's wisdom, let me read it again. For he who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. So wisdom is life, just what Solomon's been saying all along. Now, I want to show you five things that Solomon is communicating by using personification. All right? Personification of wisdom. Number one, what he's saying in the very beginning of chapter 8 and the beginning of chapter 9, both, because look how 8 begins, wisdom calls, and chapter 9, wisdom has built her house and honed and prepared and set her table and sent out her maidens, and calls, verse 3, so one calls, the other calls, right? Solomon is saying, wisdom is accessible. That's number one. Five things he's saying. The first one is, wisdom is accessible. It's accessible. Now, we saw that in when we went back to Job. Remember, Job and Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon are all wisdom books. That means they're all very metaphorical, lots of analogy, lots of metaphor, and a ton of wisdom. A ton. In fact, these five books, and the Jews actually added a couple more, they actually constitute the repository of Jewish wisdom to Jews even today. So what we have here is a lot of parallelism, a lot of connection, a lot of intersectionality between the five wisdom books. So it's no wonder we have almost word for word in Job and in Proverbs and in Psalms and Ecclesiastes. It's no wonder. It's no surprise. And we saw that back in Job chapter 28, Job said the very same thing. At the very end of chapter 28 of Job, Job says twice that God has declared and communicated where wisdom is to be found. He has told all of mankind how to get wisdom. And we have the same thing here in chapters 8 and chapter 9. We have Solomon saying wisdom is accessible. What else would it mean, verse 3 in chapter 8, beside the gates at the openings of the city, at the entrance of the doors? Huh? And in chapter 9, same thing, verse 3, from the tops of the heights of the city. Do you see? It's where people are. Solomon is saying wisdom is accessible because really, God has not hidden it. He's put it in the mix of where all people live. It's right beside you. It's right next to you. It's not hidden. It is easily, easily found. So that's the first thing he's saying. The second thing he's saying, we go over to chapter 9, and let's look at verse 7, and we'll read through 12. He who corrects a scoffer gets dishonor for himself. He who reproves a wicked man gets insults for himself. Don't reprove a scoffer, lest he hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase in learning. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. For by me your days will be multiplied, and years of life will be added to you. If you are wise, you're wise for yourself, and if you scoff, you alone will bear it. What that's basically saying is, he's already said wisdom is accessible. He says that in chapter 8. Now in chapter 9 he's saying, but it's not common. Even though it's easy to get, even though it's all around us waiting for us to reach for it, even though wisdom is right next to us, man in general spurns it. Man doesn't want it. That's why he's talking about reproving and scoffing and all these things in chapter early part of chapter 9, because that's the tendency. That's what man does. Man scorns wisdom. So the first thing he has said is wisdom is accessible. The second thing he'll say has said is wisdom is not common. The third thing that Solomon is saying, go back to chapter 8, we'll look at verse 10. And 11, verses 10 and 11, let's see what he says. Take my instruction and not silver, and knowledge rather than choicest gold, for wisdom is better than jewels, and all desirable things cannot compare with her. Do you see what he's saying? The third thing he's saying is, be sure to seek the thing that matters. Seek and value that thing which matters. Yes, seek it. So that's number 3. Also in chapter 8, which is just a sublime chapter. We'll spend some time unpacking it. But also in chapter 8, let's look at verse 12, and we'll go through 21. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogance and the evil way and the perverted mouth I hate. Counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I am understanding, power is mine. By me, kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me, princes rule and nobles, all who judge rightly. I love those who love me, and those who diligently seek me will find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, even pure gold, and my yield than choicest silver. I walk on the way of righteousness, in the midst of the paths of justice, key word, justice. To endow those who love me with wealth, that I may fill their treasuries. So the fourth thing Solomon is saying, he's making the case for wisdom to all five groups, and he's saying many of the same things he's already said, but he says it again here. He says, very valuable, he's mentioned all this gold and all this wealth, but he's also saying, wisdom is the secret of godly leaders. Do you see that? Chapter 8, verses 12 through 21 are all about leadership. They're about leaders. He's saying, you want to know how leaders do what they do? They do it with godly wisdom. That's their secret. Good leaders have wisdom from God. That's what he's saying. That's the fourth. That's the fourth thing. So let's continue. Verse 22 of chapter 8, and we'll go all the way through the end. And don't forget, we'll revisit this chapter, because it has a lot. It has a lot to unpack. But verse 22, "The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. From everlasting I was established, from the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth, when there were no depths I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills I was brought forth, while he had not yet made the earth and the fields, nor the first dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he inscribed a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above. When the springs of the deep became fixed. When he set a sea, its boundary, so that the water would not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was beside him as a master workman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in the world, his earth, and having my delight in the sons of men. Now, therefore, O sons, listen to me. For blessed are they who keep my ways, heed instruction and be wise, and do not neglect it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at my doorposts. For he who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who sins against me injures himself. All those who hate me love death." Now, there's a lot there. But you can see very plainly that the person talking isn't... Okay, there's different levels of interpretation here, and they're all correct, and we'll spend more time later on those. But for right now, the very first level of interpretation is this is wisdom speaking. It's not God speaking. It's wisdom speaking. Now, at the next level, you can interpret this as also God speaking, and there's no contradiction there, and we'll parse that out later. But right now it's wisdom, and wisdom is speaking, and it is actually saying that if you want to know how great wisdom is, I already gave you a hint about this. Do you want to know how great wisdom is? You want to know how broad and how vast and how deep and how wonderful it is? Consider the fact that wisdom created the world. Did you see that master workman thing there, verse 30? "I was beside him as a master workman." Wisdom physically created the world. And just to give you a little preview of what we'll talk about later, we are told in other places in the Bible, Colossians, for example, that Jesus Christ was the agent of creation, that he created the world. So we have a third level of interpretation possible here, and it's very appropriate also, in that we can actually find Jesus Christ, allegorized, let's say, in this chapter. Not a stretch at all. Not by any stretch. Not a stretch. So that's the fifth thing that Solomon is saying here, is that wisdom, its nature is such, it is so great, it is so wonderful, that it actually created the world. So there's five things. He says wisdom is accessible. Then he says, but even though it's accessible, for some reason, it's not common. And if you remember Job 28, that we went through that, you know the reason why it's not common. And that is, people don't want the source. People don't want wisdom because people don't want the source. The third thing Solomon says is to seek and value that which matters, which of course is wisdom. The fourth thing that Solomon says is that wisdom is the secret of godly leaders. And then the fifth thing that Solomon tells his charges, his audience, is that wisdom created the world. Well, that's going to have to be enough for this time. As I say, next time we'll unpack some more in chapters 8 and 9, and especially in chapter 9, which we haven't done a lot yet, but we'll do that next time. And given the time, I think there will be, we will embark on the other things. Remember, I told you there were three messages in this chapter. I'm sorry, in this section of chapters 8 and 9. And we'll embark on those other things, those other lessons that we can derive from these two chapters. And even get into the historical difficulty of interpreting chapter 8. There's been a lot of difficulty with it. And in fact, it did spawn, or I should say, an incorrect interpretation did spawn a heresy. The very first major heresy of the church actually came from a misinterpretation of chapter 8. So we'll see that as we get there. But thank you for coming along with me, and next time we will jump right back in and finish up, hopefully, if not finish up, then come very close to finishing up this section of chapters 8 and 9. Meantime, believe God.